This morning's Bible reading is Genesis 32. It's on page 27. And there it is. Jacob also went on his way, and the angels of God met him. When Jacob saw them, he said, "This is the camp of God." So he named that place Mahanaim. Jacob sent messages ahead of him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. He instructed them, "This is what you are to say to my lord Esau. Your servant Jacob says, 'I have been staying with Laban and have remained there till now. I have cattle and donkeys, sheep and goats, male and female servants. Now I am sending this message to my lord, that I may find favor in your eyes.'" When the messengers returned to Jacob, they said, "We went to your brother Esau, and now he's coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him." In great fear and distress, Jacob divided the people who were with him into two groups, and the flocks and herds and camels as well. He thought, "If Esau comes and attacks one group, the group that's left may escape." Then Jacob prayed, "O God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac, Lord, you who said to me, 'Go back to your country and your relatives, and I will make you prosper,' I am unworthy of all the kindness and faithfulness you have shown your servant. I had only my staff when I crossed this Jordan, but now I have become two camps. Save me, I pray, from the hand of my brother Esau, for I am afraid he will come and attack me, and also the mothers with their children. But you have said, 'I will surely make you prosper and will make your descendants like the sand of the sea, which cannot be counted.'" He spent the night there, and from what he had with him, he selected a gift for his brother Esau: 200 female goats and 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 female camels with their young, 40 cows and 10 bulls, and 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. He put them in the care of his servants, each herd by itself, and said to his servants, "Go ahead of me and keep some space between the herds." He instructed the one in the lead, "When my brother Esau meets you and asks, 'Who do you belong to? And where are you going? And who owns all these animals in front of you?' then you are to say, 'They belong to your servant Jacob. They are a gift sent to my lord Esau, and he is coming behind us.'" He also instructed the second, the third, and all the others who followed the herds, "You are to say the same thing to Esau when you meet him. And be sure to say, 'Your servant Jacob is coming behind us.'" For he thought, "I will pacify him with these gifts I'm sending on ahead. Later when I see him, perhaps he will receive me." So Jacob's gifts went on ahead of him, but he himself spent the night in the camp. That night, Jacob got up and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 sons, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. After he had sent them across the stream, he sent over all his possessions. So Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him till daybreak. When he saw that the man could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip, so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, "Let me go, for it's daybreak." But Jacob replied, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." The man asked him, "What is your name?" "Jacob," he answered. Then the man said, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with humans and have overcome." Jacob said, "Please tell me your name." But he replied, "Why do you ask my name?" Then he blessed him there. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, "It is because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared." The sun rose above him as he passed Peniel, and he was limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the Israelites do not eat the tendon attached to the socket of the hip, because the socket of Jacob's hip was touched near the tendon.
Thank you. I'll lead us in prayer. Lord, would you bless us this morning as we gather around your word? Would we be encouraged, challenged, inspired by that faith of your servant Jacob, who, though he was a strange figure in many respects, prized your blessing above all else? Would we take from this the core lesson? Amen. Now, we're covering Jacob today. This is our series of biographies on the descendants of Abraham, the sons of Abraham, we've called this series. And Jacob is an enormous life. Jacob is about half the book of Genesis. His life spans, I think, more chapters than Abraham's, last I checked, given he goes just about right to the end of it from the middle. And I'm doing that in 1 week, which is ambitious, but I'm going to blitz through some of it pretty quickly and spend a bit more time in that chapter. So let's begin at the beginning. Jacob was born grasping his brother's heel. That's what his name means, that he grasps or usurps. It says that right from the beginning he was wrestling with his brother in the womb, literally attacking, you know, feuding. And this is obviously a tell for the rest of his life. Jacob and his brother Esau had a lifelong enmity that defined the lives of their parents, but also their own lives, right through to this chapter we just read. And whereas Esau came out covered in red hair, which is delightful, like a little orangutan, Jacob came out with no mention. He had an epilator or something. He was a different boy. And this image is from the beginning very sinister. He's grasping his brother's heel, the older brother. This is seen as a sign of usurping him, you know, taking his blessing, taking his place. In the early chapters of Genesis, we see that the blessing of God typically is passing from father to the oldest son as the heir. A lot of the world used to work this way. It doesn't work this way anymore, thankfully, for second and third borns in the room, and for daughters. There are several of them here. Good the rules have changed. He was a usurper from the beginning who wanted to take the blessing from his brother. That's how he's depicted. And that he's grasping the heel is particularly sinister. Because in the beginning of Genesis, when Adam and Eve are in the garden and they sin against God, they're deceived by the serpent. God curses the serpent and says, your descendant, your seed, will be at war with the seed of Eve. And her descendant will crush you with his heel. And you will kill him by striking his heel. So there's this prophecy in the beginning that, you know, the seed or the descendant of Eve, the one who will inherit the nations, is going to crush the serpent, but the serpent's going to literally grasp his heel and kill him. So to be grasping the heel of the heir is a sinister image. He's a snake-like figure, and his name, Jacob, Jacobos, James, if you're a James, it means that. It means usurper, snake in the grass. To say it's an insult, actually. So if your parents called you James, sorry. It's an insult, yeah. But that is his name and that is his character. And this plays out immediately. Even in his early life with his brother Esau from the beginning, he deceives him with a red stew. His brother comes home hungry, famished. He cooks a red lentil stew and refuses to feed his starving brother until his brother promises to give him the birthright, the inheritance, and make him first in the order, which is a crazy trade, to give up the blessing of God and the estate of your father's house for a bowl of red stew. I made a red stew last week just so that I could feel in the spirit of this, it was really good, but I wouldn't go to hell for it, personally, though I am a redhead like Esau. Now, he continues this, and we see with Jacob that he never really trusts his schemes. You know, as much as he's this character who is defined by scheming, he is, he never really trusts his schemes. He's always hedging his own bets and doubting whether or not he can secure what he's tried to lock down with his grift. And so even though he's made this trade with Esau, he suspects it won't be respected. And so when his father is old and dying and blind, He goes to his father to receive the blessing disguised as his brother. It says that he takes a goat. Bass talked about this last week. But it bears repeating. He took the hide of a goat, put it on his shoulders, because apparently his brother's back hair was so thickly carpeted that his blind father, when he laid his hand on his back, would feel the goat hide and think, that's my boy. That's my boy. So he pretends to be his very hairy brother, deceiving his blind father and taking the blessing. But still, Jacob is uncertain. Even though he receives the blessing from his father and has taken the place now in the line, he's now the one who is carrying the promise to Abraham. Does it feel strange to you at this point that God respects this? You know, that the sort of the bureaucracy of heaven accommodates this wheeze of Jacob's, that the laying on of hands is so important that Jacob could sneak under and take the place. And God would actually, we'll come to why. It is conspicuous. But he goes then to a place called Bethel. And here is a major development, not just in his life, but in the Bible. At Bethel, Jacob sees angels ascending and descending from heaven in a place in the field. And he learns then that God is going to make a dwelling on earth, that he's not just promised a promised land that he's going to give to the people, but that God himself is going to come and dwell on the world. He learns this and he calls that place the house of God, where God will dwell. And he sets up a standing stone there and he says that he will tithe the tenth of all he gets to God, that he might build his house in this place. This is a major development. And the tithe here, I think, and this is me speculating, but I think Jacob is still yet again bargaining. You know, I think he's sort of promising a debt to God so that God will bless him. I think Jacob, we'll see, all his life doesn't really believe that God has blessed him. And he keeps trying to lock it down just a bit more. Now, he gets his just desserts over a period of about 20 years, where he has the great misfortune of meeting his father-in-law, who is just like him. He falls in love with Rachel, his fiancée, and he agrees to a bride price of 7 years hard labor in a field. I'm blitzing through here because I'm mindful we've got kids in the room, so I don't want to weigh too much on this, but 7 years of hard labor that's a pretty extravagant bride price. It's not normal or ordinary. But we get one of the most beautiful lines in the Bible, I think, when he makes this deal with his father-in-law, Laban. It says, Rachel was so beautiful and he loved her so much that though he toiled for her 7 years, it seemed as if it were a few days to him, which is very nice. But then after that few days, he gets tricked. He gets married. But then I don't really know how they pulled this off. They must have had very, very thick veils. But he has his wedding, and as he goes into the tent to be with his wife, he realizes that they've tricked him and given him the wrong sister. Just the old sister swap, apparently. And he wasn't actually interested in marrying Leah. He wanted to marry the younger daughter, Rachel. And this is the start of a very, very sad family dynamic. Actually, this isn't something Jacob chose, but he wants to also marry Rachel, and so that's respected. He ends up with two wives that he didn't really bargain for or plan for. And while he remains faithful to Leah, the unwanted wife, as much as, you know, he doesn't cast her out or anything, she's dearth of affection. She's clearly not, you know, favored. He doesn't give her as much love or attention as he gives Rachel, and his two wives spend the rest of their lives feuding with one another. Though they were sisters, maybe they hated each other already. Some two sisters hating each other. Imagine that never happens. But they certainly become rivals once married to the same man, which seems like a terrible setup, and compete with each other for his affection, so that his family becomes like a, you know, something like the secret lives of Jacob's wives or something. It becomes this very, very strange dynamic where even their servants are being pulled in and Jacob is sort of having to appease both of his wives by giving them more and more children, thinking that they'll win his affection if they can produce more offspring for him, so that he ends up with 12 sons and a daughter besides. It's a huge family. It's rife with conflict. And that plays out exactly as you'd expect with his kids warring with one another. I mean, if two sons keeps going this badly in the Bible, imagine 12. And you don't have to. We'll read the following chapters. It's horrific. It goes very badly. His family is characterized by huge resentments and feuds and a very sad rivalry between his two wives. Now, after 20 years of working for his father-in-law, who continually tricks him, changes the arrangement, changes his pay, tricks him into staying longer, he finally escapes. He realizes that he will never get away from his father-in-law's house, and that if he tries to leave, his father-in-law will probably kill him, take back his household and belongings, and that'll be it. So he makes a plan to run away in the night. He's got an enormous flock that he's amassed. If you're interested at all in like selective animal husbandry and animal breeding, there's a very strange chapter in Genesis where Jacob comes up with the weirdest ever plan. He's made this deal with Laban that all of the sheep that are born that have stripes or spots or are black, they'll belong to him. But all of the white sheep, they'll belong to Laban. And that's a bad deal for Jacob, because apparently those sheep aren't likely to have, you know, striped, spotty or black lambs. But he does this thing where he gets all these white sticks and he puts them on the water troughs. And he makes sure that whenever the sheep are mating, they're watching the stripes. And he thinks they're going to come out stripy if I do that. And incredibly, they do. Incredibly, they do. And I don't think it's because his plan actually works. I don't think that's how heritable genetics work. But he has this vision later that even though he's got this absolute harebrained scheme, God's actually blessing him. And he sees God causing the sheep to produce a strange and astonishing number of, you know, anomalous coats so that they all belong to him. And here we have again, God blessing and favoring Jacob's absolutely harebrained, sometimes quite evil schemes and dishonest schemes. God blesses them, even intervening and causing them to work when they otherwise wouldn't. It's very strange, but he gets away. And right before this chapter, he's made off. Laban, his father-in-law, predictably, has gone to do as he thought, kill him, take back his wives, his family, and the herds, and leave him for dead. But God intervenes again. God speaks with his father-in-law and says, don't even talk to him. Don't say anything, not even good or bad. Do not approach Jacob. And Laban's an idiot, so he approaches Jacob and says, God told me not to talk to you. But God, being merciful, doesn't strike him down because he leaves him. And they make a pact. They make an oath. They swear that they'll be at peace with one another, and Laban leaves. And so there's one big enemy done and dusted. But Jacob now knows that he has to cross into the promised land again, that God has promised his family. That was the blessing that he was, you know, scheming so hard to get, after all. And he knows he has to cross into that promised land where his brother Esau is. And his brother Esau, well, last he saw him, was a bit upset. So he's obviously worried about how this will go. He sends messengers ahead to try and, you know, figure out where he stands. Hey, I'm coming back. Do you want anything? He sort of offers his brother that he'll give him herds and he'll make a deal with him. It'll be favorable. Esau then, in response to that, sends 400 armed men. And that's not great. You don't have to know much about the historical context of this to know that back in the day, 400 armed men were very dangerous. That's still true, actually. Yeah, if 400 armed men are coming for you, you should probably make preparations for a funeral. But Jacob rightly panics and comes up with yet another scheme. He thinks, I'll send ahead all the flocks first, and my servants, and my goods, and my belongings, and my kids, and my wives, then me last. And his hope is, he's not hoping that they'll all die or something. He's hoped that Esau will take all of his herds, all of his belongings as a gift, and then he'll be kind of like, you know, sucked in a bit by Jacob's family. The kids are cute. Oh, look, it's my sister-in-law's. Let's be nice. And by the time he arrives, he'll have buttered him up sufficiently. But after a lifetime of schemes, Jacob really has still just learnt one thing, that unless God blesses him, he's cooked. That's really, at this point of Jacob's life, his greatest conviction, that unless God blesses him, the greatest of his schemes are just silly shenanigans. He knows that he needs God's blessing more than he needs a good plan. And so, as his whole family crosses over, and angels have met with him. Did you notice that at the top of the chapter? Jacob also went on his way, and the angels of God met him. He still is not content, and so he remains on the other side of the river. Now, this is the Jordan River. This is the river that Moses later will lead the Israelites to, and they'll be too afeard to cross in. That Joshua will lead an army across one day and take the promised land. This is the river that Jesus will be baptized in. This is the river that marks the entry to the promised land of God. But Jacob refuses to cross over until he is absolutely certain that God really has blessed him. And he doesn't trust the soup deal. He doesn't trust his father's hand. He doesn't trust the tithe he offered or anything else, even that angels are in his camp. He's not going to settle for any less than physically wrestling God, tapping him into submission, and getting a decree from the big man himself. And so this very strange scene happens. It says, that night Jacob got up, took his two wives, his two female servants, his 11 sons, crossed the ford of the Jabbok. After he'd sent them across the stream, he sent over all his possessions. So Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. You're like, who's this guy? Who's the man? Well, the commentaries have lots of interesting ideas. A lot of traditional Christian teachers have said that it can't be actually God because, first of all, God isn't incarnate yet as a man. You know, he becomes a man much later in Bethlehem. At this point in history, God has not become a man, so it can't be God. It must be some sort of appearance, and he doesn't actually wrestle with him because imagine wrestling with God and winning. You know, this... You can be pretty good at wrestling, but I don't think like I don't know who the world heavyweight UFC fighter is. I think you'd have poor odds against God, and so that he wins is very strange. It must be a metaphor, people have said. So Christians have often traditionally taught that this is sort of about prayer, that he was wrestling in prayer through the night and fervently pleading. And there's a bit of a language in the Bible that talks about him tearfully praying to God. I'm sure he's doing that at the same time as God's sort of bending his arm. The real problem with that idea that it's a metaphor is that he dislocates his hip in the wrestling. And I've never prayed so hard that happened to me. But if you have, you're very bad at praying, I think. Jacob, you're doing it weird. Jacob is plainly actually wrestling. It's you have to twist it in a knot to get around that. He is physically wrestling. And so some have said, well, maybe it's an angel appearing as a man. But he refers to him as God. He refuses to give him his name. If it were merely an angel would have no qualm giving him his name. But he encounters God in appearance as a man. The man will not give him his name yet. And further, he says, I have seen God face to face. Later, God says this of him, that he has contended with God and with men and prevailed. Very clearly, what it says is he wrestles with God, who has appeared to him in a human body as a man, and he somehow wins. And I don't think God were unable to win. But I think this is testament to the fact that God won't strike Jacob down and Jacob won't let go. That's what's happening here. God won't kill Jacob because he is blessing him. And Jacob won't let go. He contends all the night, even when God dislocates his hip, strikes him on the tendon, crippling him for the rest of his life, he still will not let go. And so God reconfirms his blessing and gives him a new name, the name Israel. And this is another titanic moment in history. This is where the word Israel comes from, the name of the nation Israel, because it was the 12 tribes of Israel, Israel being Jacob, that went into the promised land. That's the name the nation is then given. But the name means those who contend with God, those who wrestle with him. That is the relationship between God's people and God for the rest of the Bible, and quite arguably into the present, we're a bit like this. We contend with God, we grieve him, we struggle with him. But the nature of Jacob's faith is that he will not let go. That's how he prevails. And so God rewards this. I think because God always rewards faith in the blessing. What does Jacob demonstrate? He demonstrates that he would rather face his brother crippled physically with a maimed leg with God's blessing than healthy and strong with his own schemes and plans without it. For all of Jacob's strange relationship with God and his promises, one thing is certain of him. He has abiding faith that the blessing of God is far and away the most important thing that he could ever have. And this, God esteems this so highly, this confidence in the blessing of God, that all else about his character seems to fall by the wayside. So Esau, who is in many ways the better man, you know, the braver man, the more honest man, he's not the man of faith. And so God scorns him because Jacob is the one who sees God as being above all else. I think that's a profound picture. But I'll move through the rest of his life before I make a couple of reflections on that. When he reaches Esau, he limps across the Jordan. The sun rises over him as he does, it says, a beautiful image. And Esau very miraculously lets him go. If you read the next chapter, it's interesting. You might mistake it for kindness, but what happens in the next chapter is that Esau tries to sneakily attach Jacob's house and his herds into his own. You know, he tries to leave fighting men with him, or, you know, say, just stay with me a while. But this is the kind of deal, is exactly the kind of thing his father-in-law was doing, to fold Jacob into his own household and entrap him so that he would become part of Esau's house. But Jacob manages to get out of this by his own shrewdness in some part, but by God's blessing more greatly. And he runs away again from Esau, and he goes back to Bethel, that place in which he promised he would tithe to God, who would become a dwelling place on earth. He consecrates his household here. This is interesting. It says at this point that him and his house, they put away all their other gods. They stop worshipping other gods. And if you hadn't been paying attention, you might not have realized, but they were. To this point, Jacob's wives kept the idols of their father-in-law. They were worshipping other gods, practicing idolatry. They were worshipping God and other things. But here, at this point, Jacob consecrates the whole house so that none of them can worship any god but God alone, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, now the God of Jacob, the God of Israel. And he receives a blessing, which is not just a reconfirmation of the blessing to Abraham. This is a huge moment. He receives a blessing from God, which is not just that his son will be blessed. That's what's happened before. Abraham was told, your son. Isaac was told, your son. Oops, wrong son. Jacob is told, your sons. And so whereas Jacob and Esau sort of fought for scraps between each other where one could get the blessing, all 12 sons of Jacob receive the blessing of God. Not in equal measure, you know, to varying degree, but all of them are blessed so that all of them together will be now kept together and inheriting together. And Jacob himself contends for this. Interestingly, later on, even as Jacob nears the end of his own life and he goes blind, Joseph, you know, his favorite son, and this is funny of Jacob, he was the youngest son and he knew what it was like for the father to favor the older. Well, Jacob favors the younger sons always. He favors his youngest sons far above his oldest. He just does it the other way around. But Jacob blesses, when Joseph comes forward with his sons, Jacob blesses his grandsons with his arms crossed over. So as Joseph brings his oldest and his second born, Jacob is meant to put his right hand on the oldest, his left hand on the youngest, but he goes, nope. He didn't like when that happened last time. And he puts his right hand on the youngest son. And Joseph is incensed by this, but Jacob says, God blesses the younger, the smaller. I'll speak to that in a moment, but this is where that thought enters in, where God blesses the smaller, the lesser, the unexpected, the undeserving, the one who would not inherit according to the world is the one who gets the greater blessing here on in. Now, after he reconsecrates his house to Bethel, this is, you know, before the next big saga of his life, which will be then taken over by what happens with Joseph, which we'll talk about in later weeks, he sets out to take possession of the promised land very conspicuously by going down to Bethlehem. Now, at the time he did this, it wasn't called Bethlehem. In fact, at the time Genesis was written, it wasn't called Bethlehem. So the note here that it is, you know, this place is Bethlehem is a later addition, probably from the time of David. You know, it's conspicuous that to take possession of the promised land, he goes out of Bethel, the house of God, and now goes down to Bethlehem to do that. But as he travels, Rachel, who is pregnant and would give birth in Bethlehem, doesn't get the whole way. She gets half the way and she dies. And so his youngest son is born then and he has no others. And he doesn't actually continue on. He goes back then and returns to the place where he lived with his father and where Abraham kept his tents. It's a very conspicuous image. He doesn't quite get to Bethlehem. It's not him. And that's, I think, you know, to later writers in the Bible, a very clear picture of the hope that God will appoint the King David from that place. But for us, something more important, the birth of Jesus. Jacob's life points forward to Jesus very conspicuously. We see in Jacob a wrestling match with God who appears to him as a man and blesses him for attacking him. It's interesting that God blesses this. I'll say not too much on that, except to say that it's not as if God already became a man back at this point. He really does become a man in Bethlehem at a later date when Jesus is born. But when Jacob encounters God as a man, he's encountering an appearance of God's plan to do this, of which Jacob is conscious. You know, Jacob knows that God has appeared to him as a man. Jacob knows that God is going to make a dwelling place and a home. Jacob is the one who named it, Bethel. And so Jacob is engaging here with the Christ, a vision of him at least, an image of him appearing to him and fighting him. And Jacob, I think, realizes something, that God doesn't bless the worthy, the important, the strong, the mighty, but the least. This is my real main reflection that I was thinking on as I read through Jacob's life, that it's so unintuitive to look at the world and watch how things play out and think that God is blessing the vulnerable one, or that God might be blessing or choosing the one who doesn't inherit, the weaker, the lesser. And Jacob's life doesn't most of the time look particularly blessed, actually. And yet we have here this clear picture that whatever it looks like outwardly, whatever looks scary or strong, whatever looks impressive, God is blessing the unimpressive. And Jacob, in knowing this, testifies to it by receiving the blessing. Now, second, and this was a challenge to me to think about, I reckon I could not have wrestled God for a whole night because I find it really hard to get up when the kids are crying. And I struggle with a little bit of sleep on the best of occasions. I reckon I'm probably 5 minutes in. Probably too scared to attack God to begin with, actually. Jacob persists through all kinds of ordeals in his life that for most of us we would balk at the first hurdle. Why is this? What is this? It's faith, isn't it? Faith greater than any of us, I think. What fraction of Jacob's ordeal would any of us give up at? We're not all heroes, are we? You know, what small detail of Jacob's horrific ledger of woes would write us off before we gave up on trusting in God? I think once the hip's dislocated, you're surely letting go. But no, bless me, I will not leave without the blessing. It's worth noting God rewards this. Jacob does not think that he must serve God in ways that are immediately and right now good for him. Jacob doesn't think that he needs to, have confidence that God's blessing is always going to come with some sort of like obvious material sign, so that, you know, like, you know, he doesn't think that just because his hip's dislocated, God hasn't blessed him. He limps, he's crippled, but he knows that he has God's blessing more from that point because of God's promise. Jacob doesn't look at the outward things. I think we do. How often do we give in ways that are advantageous to us or we can afford? And I was thinking about this. At my former parish I used to work at, we swapped out all the pews for chairs. You know, heaven forbid, right? Actually, wouldn't recommend it. It just created a whole lot of stacking. People go, oh, but you can't move the pews. That's the point. It's so good. You just like, it's not an option. Leave them. So much work when you got chairs. But there was a group of people that lobbied and said, we will not give money toward the chair refits unless we get these extra wide, you know, first class airline, 20 centimeters wider, deeper cushion versions that are much heavier, harder to stack, and reduce the church's capacity by 50 people. Literally, we will not give money unless we're more comfortable for fewer people. So we reduced the capacity of the church, made it more comfortable for the people who were there, and people would not give unless we did that. We do that sometimes, don't we? We serve in ways where we feel like we're kind of more encouraged and empowered in what we would like to do. We give in ways and toward causes where we feel more ownership and connection. I don't think that faith always thinks this way. I think faith has the character of giving sacrificially, not reciprocally, of serving sacrificially. You know, I think of this myself. I loathe and dread doing kids' talks. I actually NA them when I get rostered. But maybe I oughtn't. I find that I want to serve in the ways that I like to. I want to give to the cause and the things that I like. And I want to withhold when I'm not appreciating my ROI. I think the character of faith is to contend for the blessing even when it's insane, let alone when it's just a bit hard. But we're not called to wrestle with God. We don't have to do anything like that. God promises us assuredly that we have the blessing. How much more should we trust that and then trust that we can sacrificially serve, give, all things? But I'll lead us in prayer. Lord God, would you bless us even more greatly than you blessed Jacob, because as you blessed him, you also wouldn't tell him your name. That came later. But we know your name, Jesus, God saves. Now, we know that your name means that you are merciful, you are kind, you are gracious, that we don't have to fight you. We simply trust you. But would you bless us, Lord, to trust you not any less or with less urgency or in its own way wrestling than Jacob, but give us this character of unmitigated and unqualified faith, because if we see in him a sinful figure, a liar, a schemer, a usurper even, well, we also see how much you bless him, and we see therefore that this faith in you and your promise is of such surpassing and great value that all else falls to the wayside. So give us this faith, we pray, and bless us in it. Amen.